Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today, we begin by going to the Ukraine. How did the U.S. become so involved with this former Soviet republic? Well, perhaps to begin answering that, we should look at the question, how did the modern Ukraine emerge? Ukraine's history is intertwined with Russia's. Both cultures descend from the medieval Slavic empire, Kievan Rus, founded by the Vikings in the 9th century, with their capital, where Kiev stands today. After the empire was overrun by Mongol invaders in the 13th century, the Rus leadership moved northeastward to a small trading outpost they called Moscow. The lands around Kiev were carved up by competing powers who prized the fertile plains and the rich, dark soil that later earned Ukraine the nickname the breadbasket of Europe. Poland and Lithuania dominated the country for hundreds of years. But by the end of the 18th century, the Russian Empire had taken the eastern lands, while the western lands were controlled by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, a division that resonates to this very day. Both empires collapsed at the end of World War I, and in 1917, a Ukrainian state was declared. But it was quickly swallowed by the Communist Soviet Union. It became then an SSR, or a Soviet Socialist Republic. It was only in 1991, after the Soviet Union dissolved, that the modern borders of Ukraine were established. Russia has never really accepted Ukraine's independence, and Ukraine has been careening between pro-Western and pro-Russian leaders ever since. Well, just why do Russians still see Ukraine as theirs? The cultural and Orthodox religious ties between the two peoples go back for centuries. But perhaps more importantly, Russia has no natural mountain or river borders to protect its western front, and it has long seen Ukraine as a vital strategic buffer. Russia without Ukraine is a country, says one international politics professor. Russia with Ukraine is an empire. Russian President Vladimir Putin wants at all costs to keep Ukraine out of the European Union and NATO, and he has used Ukraine's dependence on Russian natural gas as his weapon, cutting off supplies in 2006 as Ukrainians froze in the winter cold. Ukraine is bitterly divided between Ukrainian speakers in the West, who mostly want to align their country with the West, and Russian speakers in the East. Well, why did the U.S. get involved, you might ask? Since 1991, the U.S. has sought to guarantee Ukraine's independence and its security, seeing it as a key bridge between East and West. When the USSR dissolved, Ukraine inherited the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, with some 1,900 strategic nuclear weapons pointed at the United States. Keen to avoid a proliferation of nuclear powers, the U.S., the United Kingdom, and Russia, in 1994 signed the Budapest Memorandum, which transferred the weapons to Russia in exchange for a commitment by Washington, Moscow, and London to respect the independence and sovereignty and the existing borders of Ukraine, and to refrain from the threat or the use of force against it. Russia continued meddling in Ukrainian politics, though, and overtly broke the treaty in 2014. What did Russia do? Ukraine's 2004 election was a showdown between pro-Western candidate Viktor Yushchenko and pro-Russian Viktor Yanukovych. During the campaign, Yushchenko was disfigured by dioxin poisoning, widely attributed to Russia, and after the vote, was rigged by Yanukovych. Ukrainians then rose up in the Orange Revolution, which culminated in a revolt and a victory for Yushchenko. In the 2010 election, though, Yanukovych came roaring back to win the presidency with the help of both Russia and American political consultant Paul Manafort. Moscow, in 2013, forced Yanukovych to cancel the country's bid to move closer to the European Union, leading to an uprising that forced Yanukovych out of office. In the tumult that ensued, Russia invaded and annexed Crimea, and later sent troops into Ukraine's eastern regions to start a separatist war. The Obama administration punished Russia with sanctions, but chose not to send weapons to Ukraine out of fear of triggering a larger war. Before we start our next item for the day, I want to remind you that you can read more about Ukraine in The Week magazine of December 6th, 2019. Now I've found a very intriguing article in Time magazine of about that same time, the December 2nd through 9th. Of last year. It's entitled The Fight for Our Faces. China shows the worrying future of the surveillance state. We're going to the interior of China to begin with, to the city of Chongqing, which has the dubious distinction of being the world's most surveilled city. The seething mass of 15 million people straddling the confluence of the Yangtze and the Jialing rivers boasted a 2.58 million surveillance number of cameras in 2019, according to an analysis published in August by the tech research website Comparatech. In the city of Chongqing is seemingly captured digitally. Cameras perch over sidewalks. They hover across busy intersections, and they swivel above shopping districts. But Chongqing is by no means unique. 8 of the top 10 most surveilled cities in the world are in China, according to Comparatech. As the world's number 2 economy rolls out an unparalleled system of social control, it is aided by CCTV. Facial recognition software is used to access office buildings, to snare criminals, and even to shame jaywalkers at busy intersections. China today is a harbinger of what society looks like when surveillance proliferates unchecked. This with the application of artificial intelligence. But while few nations have embraced surveillance the way China has, it is far from alone. Surveillance has become an everyday part of life in most developed societies, aided by an explosion in artificial intelligence and a powering of the facial recognition technology that it allows. Last year, London police made their first arrest based on facial recognition by cross-referencing photos of pedestrians in tourist hotspots with a database of known felons. A few months earlier, a trial of facial recognition software by police in New Delhi, India, reportedly recognized 3,000 missing children in only 4 days. The technology is widespread in the U.S. too. It has aided in the arrest of alleged credit card swindlers in Colorado and a suspected rapist in Pennsylvania. Still, the risks are considerable. As Western democracies enact safeguards to protect citizens from the rampant harvesting of data by government and by corporations, China is exporting its artificial intelligence-powered surveillance technology to authoritarian governments around the world. Chinese firms are providing high-tech surveillance to be used as tools in at least 18 nations from Venezuela to Zimbabwe. This according to a 2018 report by Freedom House. China is a battleground where the modern surveillance state has reached a nadir, prompting censure from governments and institutions around the globe. But it is also where rebellion against its overreach is being most ferociously fought. Now we go to the Smithsonian Institution. The Smithsonian Magazine encourages readers to send in questions for its experts to answer. And these were some questions that I found in the November 2019 issue. The first question says, Texas has a marker stating that Jacob Brodbeck was the first person to fly an airplane. I was taught that it was the Wright brothers. What gives here? That's a letter from Richard DeLong from San Antonio, Texas. And the answer he was given is this. Ignore that plaque. Even before Orville and Wilbur Wright made history at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, in 1903, there were dozens of claims about and by other inventors of having achieved flight, and they are all, including Broadbeck's, discredited or unsubstantiated. What's remarkable about the Wright brothers' achievement isn't just that they were the first to get a plane off the ground. They wanted to create what they called a machine of practical utility. And with the 1903 Wright Flyer, they engineered a design that would evolve into a lasting technology. Every airplane that followed that machine to this day flies on the same basic principles. Another question: how does a hippopotamus swim so fast? Well, they're not actually swimming. They're actually galloping, explains the curator at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. Hippos, which spend up to 16 hours a day in water, do not swim. They either walk underwater or they bounce and propel themselves across the riverbed with their webbed toes. Though they can weigh over 4 tons, their low bone density and their fat increases their buoyancy, making it much easier to move through water. And it certainly helps if they can hold their breath for minutes at a time. And our last question for the day was sent in by Mai Schweibaum from Morgan Hill, California. She wants to know, what is at the center of neutron stars? Neutron stars are the compact relics of collapsed massive stars and are largely made out of neutrons and some protons. Beyond that, things are hazier. When a massive star collapses into a neutron star, the neutrons and the protons at its center are squished together at such a high density that it might create new particles like quarks and kaons and pions. Scientists are currently unable to recreate that high density, low temperature state of matter in terrestrial experiments. But NASA's Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer, that mission might get to the core of the issue. An X-ray tracing device on the International Space Station, called NICER, will measure the mass and the radius of the neutron stars. And with that data, scientists can calculate the pressure on the inside of the star, which will offer hints about its composition. That's all very deep stuff, isn't it? And here is a current note about fighting Ebola. Ebola could soon be classified as a curable disease, thanks to a trial of experimental treatments in Congo. An epidemic of the hemorrhagic disease has killed more than 2,200 people in the African nation. About 70% of those who catch Ebola die. But the death rate plummeted to 29% for patients on one new drug and 34% for those on another. Among patients who began treatment soon after developing symptoms, rates fell to 6% and 11% respectively. The drugs use monoclonal antibodies. These are Y-shaped proteins that call on immune cells to attack the Ebola virus. That's the important part of this. The disease kills 12,000 Americans during mild flu seasons and up to 56,000 in severe ones, with 90% of the victims over 65 years of age. Many people don't get vaccinated, however, and either because they fear getting the shot or they believe it isn't effective. But just how effective is it? The vaccine's effectiveness varies dramatically, depending on how well it matches the viruses that circulate in a given season. In good years, the vaccine protects 50 to 70% of the people receiving it. But some strains are more difficult to create vaccines for, such as the H3N2 type, which raged during the severe flu season in 2017. That year's vaccine was found to be only 40% effective overall, but nevertheless, doctors recommended getting this shot anyway, because even some immunity helps to slow the spread of the disease. Vaccination can also make symptoms of any flu infection less severe, even if it doesn't completely prevent the illness. We do have something in the works, says Peter Palese, a virologist at the ICOM School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. It's not perfect, but it's better than not having any vaccination. Today's show with several items that you probably won't read, or hear about elsewhere. That's why this program is important. First of all, the Hallmark Channel produced 40 separate holiday movies for its annual Countdown to Christmas Bonanza, with an average budget of $2 million. The ad revenue for Hallmark in 2018 was $600 million. Some $9 billion has been raised on the charitable crowdfunding site GoFundMe through more than 120 million donations since 2010. This year, a fundraiser was started every 8 seconds. So if you haven't done so, you don't have much time. About 400 of America's largest corporations paid an average federal tax rate of 11% on their profits last year, roughly half the rate established under the 2017 tax law. 91 Fortune 500 corporations paid no federal tax at all. We should be so lucky. Please tune in next time. Enjoy having you here. I couldn't do this without you. So until then, goodbye.